I'm actually on a personal note. I'm from Smithfield, Virginia, which is not far from. So I view him as a home person, homeboy here. And but we welcome you to Milwaukee. And actually, I'm going to call on our state conference vice president, Mr. Wendell Harris, at this time, who will go from here.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you,
Reverend Barber. Yes, on behalf of President Lily Wilson, Wisconsin, greetings, Dr. Barber. I'll just echo what my president said, President Hall, and I'll add a little bit, share with you a private conversation President Hall and I had a few months ago before I met you. In our conversation, we were talking about what we were seeing taking place and happening around North Carolina and you, and he said, well, Wendell, you know, we have the first thing. He said, wouldn't it be great if we could do in Wisconsin what they're doing in North Carolina? And I said, well, let's try. And we were fortunate to, I was at a state, at a conference, a regional conference in Detroit, and Region 3 voted that the region would, all of us would work on becoming members of the Moore Monday Movement. That's how Dr. Barber started at that conference. So in Wisconsin, I don't have to say how involved it is what we passed and the laws that we passed here. We all know what's happening to our children. We know what our prison industrial complex is doing. We know what our education system is doing. That's not providing the resources that we need. So we need to take this fight to the powers to be. And that's the state house. So I hope this is the start of that movement when you're walking. Dr. Barber, thank you for joining us. And we're here to support you.
Thank you, sir.
And we'll be with you all the way.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Well, I'm glad, first of all, to be here, and Mr. President, and, you know, I first got in touch with Wisconsin when people from this state came down and went to jail in North Carolina. I don't know if you know that. There are several people that came down last summer. One young man came down, and he got arrested. A white guy, I can't remember his name, but maybe we'll see him tomorrow. Thank you. And he actually, he actually went to jail, and some other people came down. A good friend of Dr. Tim Tyson. And this movement, I was telling Wendell and Lily, state president, is 7 years in the making. It's not just something that happened overnight. And I'll talk a lot about that tomorrow. You know, there are three things I say when we go around the NAACP. The uniqueness of the NAACP historically is that we understand that every state has national implications. So you don't have to have a national person to come in and lead your movement. We build state leadership. That's where your leadership comes. Movements start from Milwaukee up, Birmingham up, Montgomery up. They don't come from D.C. now. So one of the ways when I come in and invited in to train coalition, it is not to say this is the way to do it. It's to say here's some best practices and we'll share them with you. But you have to do them. It's like in the Bible, each prophet had a region. You know, I had a guy tell me the other day, he said, man, I heard about what you're doing in North Carolina. I'm going to bring all my church folk down to North Carolina. I said, Doc, let me tell you what. I caught him. His state was Texas. I said, Doc, you need to take them church folk to the state capital in Texas. So we got North Carolina. I said, you know, he said, well, Doc, you know, I said, no. He said, well, you got a movement. I said, well, you need a movement. You know, now, if you want to come down and visit and learn a few things and learn what not to do, because I'm also talking about mistakes tomorrow, and nobody should be arrogant enough to do it, but the key is state-based. Alec and the Tea Party learned that. They decided in 1974, there's a speech out there by Charles Koch, where he said, we're not going to invest in candidates, we're going to invest in building structure at the state level and think tanks. And that's how, and then we'll produce candidates. Most progressives, we invested in Messiah candidates, but then when the campaign is over, the structure is gone. They built structure, state by state. They decided, we'll give you the Congress. We're going to go control state capital. Because if we can control state capital, we can cut taxes, we can cut education, we can control voting laws, and we can control who ends up in Congress, because all we got to do is gerrymander the district. So state conferences and local branches are more important than they've ever been. And branches at the local level have to take on, you know, in those local levels, but at the state level, the ability to build coalition is the only way we can beat that. Now, we can't build these coalitions with a Republican-Democrat language. We can't build them with conservative versus liberal. You get trapped in that. What we found is you have to have a deeper language, a language that doesn't call people to go left or right, but calls them to go deeper. See, we're in a period of time, we got to almost have a recovery of the soul of the nation. And I'll talk some tomorrow about Reconstruction. Actually, I'm going to show a little film on Reconstruction, why we believe we're right in the middle of a third Reconstruction. And the only time America has reconstructed itself is when black, white, Native Americans, Asians, and other folk have come together around agendas that draw people in, and what Jim Wallace says, puts a moral narrative with a face on it. In other words, you got to declare that these laws are immoral. People get that. They get that deep in here. Most people don't believe in stepping on people when they're down and hurting people. So you got to expose the immorality of it, expose the unconstitutionality of it, but then you got to put a face on it. And I'll talk tomorrow about tomorrow, Monday stage. For instance, politicians don't get on the stage. Presidents don't just get to speak on that. We put people on the stage that are affected by the policies. So that what happens is, because where progressive also make up, and where even sometimes we in civil rights activism at some time today, is we'll have leaders talking about the problem, but not have the people who are facing the problem talk about the problem. Right, you got to build movements around that, and I'll talk tomorrow a lot about fusion coalition. The last thing I say to NAACP is to do this work, and I say this with a lot of love because I've been in NAACP since I was a kid. I was a branch youth president, worked in college, I've worked on executive committee, now been state president almost 10 years. Miss Allen is one of our field secretaries. If you're going to build a coalition, once you get the money, don't even talk about building a coalition. Because this movement has got to be built because it needs to be built. You know, we had 80,000 people to show up in February, and I get calls all over the country saying, "Rep. Robert, how much? What was your budget?" I said, "We didn't have a budget." They said, "Well, how much money? You must have spent a couple $100,000. I said, "I think at the end of the day, we had about $40,000 that we spent, maybe if it was that much." They said, "Well, we've been doing this for the last 7 years." They said, "Well, how many grants you have?" I said, "We got a little money for the last 2 years. The first 5 years, we had a vision and we had the commitment." And so sometimes in the NAACP, we make the decision of deciding, making the movement based on the money, rather than trusting if we build a movement, the money will come. I'm going to talk some about that. That's a different perspective. The other thing is, the NAACP, and I say this to Pamela, you can't build coalitions by, let me see if I say this way. Most people that buy introduction don't deserve it. Mm-hmm. And most people that deserve one don't want it. So if you're going to build a coalition, yeah, we know we got 104 years of history. We know how old we are. But you can't walk in the room talking other folks down. You can't say it's our thing. Like the Forward Together Tomorrow movement, everybody knows the NAACP is leading it, but we don't throw that in front of everybody all the time. We talk about the coalition. We know we're leading. Our shield is up there every time we meet. I don't have to keep saying that. You know, I don't get it bogged down in our bureaucracy. The coalition is much broader. It's 200 different organizations. And it's not, and we didn't create another organization. What I said we have to do, if we are the NAACP and if we claim to be a leader, there are two things that determine whether your claim to be a leader is true or not. Number one is who's beside you and who's behind you. And if all you can get the people in your family to follow you. You're not a leader. You just got a family to follow. See, in my house, I'm the daddy. That don't mean I'm a leader in the community. But I will get my children to follow me. If they don't do nothing but out of fear. But what proves I'm a father of the community is how many other people that don't have family ties to. Mm-hmm. See, so if the NAACP claims to be a leader, the issue is not, your branch has got to come because they're going to take out a pay assessment. You know, you can have a state committee, they have to come. See, that's one. The question is, who can you get to follow you that doesn't have to be there, but they're there because they understand the intersectionality of our issues? That's what we're going to be talking about tomorrow. How do you do that without creating new organizations, but create transformative, what I call transformative fusion coalitions that deal with the issue of race and poverty? People ask me, well, is the issue race or economic poverty? I said, it is. It's both of them. And you got to deal with them in a second. So let me give you an example, a funny example. And I was telling Wendell about this one day. So not back here too long ago, our legislature, which like yours is extreme, our government, I'm going to say today at the press conference, we're dealing with the two most extreme state governments in the country, Wisconsin and North Carolina, I would say. They were debating this new voter suppression bill. Didn't y'all pass voter ID bill this time? Have the courts turned that around yet? They're going to stay?
We won some recently. We won in state court and we won in federal court.
Against voter IDs.
Yeah.
But that was a recent victory, wasn't it?
Well, the state court victory was more than a year ago. The federal court victory won a couple months ago.
That's what I'm saying, it was recent. Which y'all get?
Yeah.
And y'all gave us a lot of, because we're in court now, the same thing.
Right.
But my point is, we were in a debate one day, and we had our coalition in the room. This was in the legislature. Now, when people think NAACP, they think black, right? They think black. Which, when actually out, the NAACP is not a black organization. It's a civil rights organization. But it's founded for them just black. But they normally think when we go to the podium, we're going to talk black. So this particular day, we decided to mess up everybody. Because when you have a coalition, you can do different kinds of things. So there's an 80-some-year-old white woman from Georgia who knows how to speak race issues well. And you got to have a situation where white people can speak and talk about race, not just black people. I know we need that in the South, and I would think you need that up here, too. And so she leaned over to me and said, since we got the coalition in here today, let's mess with them. I said, what are we going to do? She said, I'm going to go to the podium and criticize them based on race. She works with the women's group, and one of the big women's groups in the state. I said, well, if you do that, I'll go to the podium and I'm going to hit the issue of women. So she walks to the podium, President Hall. She's 85 years old. She points her finger. She says, I know exactly what y'all doing. I know you because I've eaten with you. I've seen you. I saw you down in Georgia. You're passing these laws because the black people in this state are 23% of the electorate, and you're scared to death because you know if they hook up with people like me, we're going to get all y'all out of office. And y'all know what you're doing. And she was very articulate. She ran out. And the guy said, ma'am, are you, I thought you were here representing the women. She said, I'm here standing up for my people. So, you know by now the media is like, right like this. So then I go to the podium and I say, I'm Reverend Dr. William Bob, President of the State NAACP. I want to thank my sister for articulating the issues and how these policies are negative impact on black people. Today I would like to talk about this policy in relation to how they affect women. So the chair said, Mr. Reverend Bob, you want to talk about what? I said, I'm going to talk about how they affect women. I said, she's already laid out, and I have a sheet here with all of the negative impact on African Americans, but I want to go deeper than that and say, your policies are not just hurting us, they're hurting everybody. In fact of the matter, the reality is 67% of the people that you're hurting are women, 347,000 people in the state don't have voter ID, and 67% of them are women, and so many of them are white women, and the media's writing. So the story that comes out, White Women Organization stands up for Black and NAACP builds coalition with women. And now we have a bond in that state with women groups like Planned Parenthood and all of that, that you can't break. Because true coalition is not just you in the coalition for your issue.
Right.
You have to be in the coalition for all of the issues and outsmart your adversary. Right. And so, and then the last thing is language is so critical. That's why we say moral. You know, because think about it. I think our governor, he called us outsiders. One of his other legislators called us morons. One of them called us a bunch of fools. One of them called me a buffoon bishop because I wear my stole it every time we go to the legislature. They call us all these names. And so one reporter from the AP one day said, why do they keep calling y'all names? I said, oh, I'm glad you asked the question. I said, the reason we started out with a moral language is because it deepens the conversation and it disarms your enemy. So the guy to me said, what do you mean? I said, well, if we were talking about these issues are ultra-conservative versus progressive, first of all, we're going to push some people away. Because if they're not progressive, then they could be with us. But when we say they're immoral, how can the government come back and say, I just cut 500,000 people from Medicaid and it was the moral thing to do? So right there we have the debate advantage. So once you, and I say what you do is you put them in linguistic trauma. So they can't debate you. There's no language to come back at you. So the only thing they can then do is deride you and talk about you, which then makes them look small. And you keep elevating. You keep elevating, see? And then when you put that face on, like every one of our, like yesterday, on Monday, and you have to work hard at this. On Monday, I was on stage with a white, nine-generation Republican. Now think about this. She was the keynote speaker at our hall Monday. Someone said, "Now, Bob, you guys." I said, "Sure." We went up, we found her. We know it was you. We found her in Mitchell County. She called the governor stupid. Now, I had called him stupid. You see what I'm saying? She's a teacher. And she's nine-generation Republican. But she cannot stand this Tea Party attack on public education. Now, we don't agree on everything, but we agree on public education and health care. And that, for me, is enough. See? Because Jesse Helms taught me a lesson a long time ago. You remember Jesse Helms?
Yeah.
All right. Jesse Ham went to his office one day, and Jesse Ham said, "Boy, just like that." He said, "Boy, you can have some of this cooking tea over here, and if you need anything." He was great on constituent service. If you had somebody overseas, you need to get home from. And I said, "Senator Ham, me and some other preachers." I said, "We want to talk to you about policy." He said, "Well, I'll tell you, boy. I got 10 minutes, because y'all not going to change my mind." And I said, "Senator Hams," I said, "well, we were voters." He said, "You are." He said, "But I'm not trying to get all y'all." He just said, "I ain't trying to get all your voters." He said, "All I need is 51%. And I can put that coalition together anytime, any day." I thought I got so pissed. I went out and then something said, "Look, boy, a broke clock is right twice a day. Calm down and learn."
Right.
So I calmed down. And I said, you know, that's the truth. We don't have to win everybody. So if I can get that white woman Republican in Mitchell County to stand with me against public education and call her own governor that name and say that she's not going to vote for him anymore and that she's going to organize Republicans to not to support everything the NAACP do, but they're going to, that's another piece of that 51%. And we got to learn that you don't have to have somebody with you all the way. We put together a coalition on the issue of same-sex marriage. People say, how you going to do that, Reverend? I said, first of all, let's get some folk in the room and talk about it from a civil rights perspective, not whether or not you agree with same-sex marriage as a matter of your religion. because that's protected. The First Amendment protects you from freedom of and freedom of religion, freedom from and freedom of religion. So what you do in your church and what you do personally is between you, your God, your pastor, your priest, and your imam. But there's another question out there. What do you do with the 14th Amendment that says equal protection under the law for every citizen? Doesn't say anything about sexuality, creed, color, anything. They said, yeah, that's right. I said, okay. Then let's go together and let's get some clergy together, get other folk together, and first of all, unpack that the same people that are attacking the LGBT community are also against voting rights, they're against health care, they're against all the other stuff that we fight for. We as black people are all uptight. Man, y'all stop being so oversexed and just look at this thing. And you don't have to go out and embarrass someone. You don't have to promote. Nobody's trying to make you mad. We're talking about civil rights. And so we said, now wait a minute. If the 14th Amendment, which is our amendment, because it came out of the aftermath of slavery, said equal protection under law, doesn't that apply to all people? They said, yeah. I said, well, why can't your position be, it doesn't matter whether you agree or disagree with same-sex marriage personally, number or religiously. Number one, we disagree with the people that are attacking people's civil rights, because the same people attack us. So the people that attack us can't come over here in our community and tell us to attack somebody when they are attacking us. We would be fools to join the people that are attacking us attacking somebody else. Number two, if it's an equal protection clause, you could, if this is your position, be against same-sex marriage in your personal religion, but support people's constitutional rights. That's a different thing. So one preacher said, no, you can't. I said, you do it every Sunday. What you talking about? I said, do your ushers ask people what they did last night? So when your woman come through the door of your church, do your ushers do a check of them? Do you say, okay, I need to know now, who did you sleep with last night? Did you gamble last night? Do you do that? I said, no, it's what you do. You, in the church, you practice equal protection under the law. You say, whosoever will. He said, okay, doc. I said, I know you practice when it comes to time.
That's right.
You know, so don't be, but my point is, by doing that, one day we had preachers, we had ministers, some ministers who actually believe and perform same-sex marriage, others who don't, but they all stood united in a coalition against those who were trying to make it unconstitutional. See what I'm saying? Building coalitions. A few weeks ago, we had a Republican and a Democrat who both agreed with labor. They're on the same stage. A white man who was Republican, who lost his unemployment benefits because our government lets it cut it. And a black man who's a labor person who lost his, put that face on. So now the media is reporting these policies of this government are extreme. You can't understand them just in that limited lane. And that's the power of a moral argument. It allows you to embrace people. That one day we had a multi-millionaire businessman who hired 300 people. Almost 1,000 people go to jail as an unemployed worker. And the media said, why are you going through a slip of this thing? He said, well, I'm rich, but I don't think my wealth gives me the right to treat this man wrong. So a moral argument is like a magnet. It makes people take a second thought, you know, look again at what's going on. And it has power. I'm telling you, power to bring people together in ways I'll talk some of it about tomorrow. Now, here's the other side of it. No cameras on media in here, right? No media. Huh? They hear you? Oh, you're media. Okay. I didn't know he was here yet. Okay.
You media too?
Okay. Well, I wish y'all could, but that's all right. It's good. So y'all let me know when the press gets started. But the power of moral movement too is it brings We have seen diversity happen at a, what I almost call a miracle level. I'm talking about sometimes rally, we have rallies and 60% of the people out there white in the South. NAACP, big old yellow and blue seal up there. And you look out in the audience and you see white, black, Latino, Native American, and all in vast numbers holding hands together, saying we're united around the common agenda. Now, the agenda that we have found, I'll say this, is any other media thing? I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, the state climate, we'll be able to recognize
right.
it, but go ahead.
So, you know, one of the reasons I was so excited about coming to Milwaukee, because I know Milwaukee is the Selma of the North. And I know the history of Father Grope and the history of Dr. King coming through here. So this year I've had two great privileges, humbling privileges, and that is to be one of the keynote speaker at the 49th anniversary of the March Across the Heaven's Petit Bridge. They invited the Forward Together movement back, and we got an award on behalf of the movement for maintaining, you know, continuing the movement. The second highlight was to be here, because I know that this history, and I also know, some people might argue, but I would almost argue that Scott, your governor, and our governor, and your speaker, and our speaker, and your legislator, are about the most extreme state legislature in the country at the present time. About the most extreme. So I was glad when President Wilson had to come. I was glad when people, Patrick, from over in Madison. Patrick Barrett. Some of the other people who had come down, invited us to come. One of the leaders in our movement, Dr. Tim Tyson, used to be at the University of Wisconsin. That's in Madison, right? He's one of the great historians. Actually, he's a white brother, Caucasian brother, who is a student of a PhD in African American Studies, and he serves on our executive committee. The reality is, we think in this movement that we're in a battle against extremism. It's not merely about Democrat, Republican, liberal versus conservative. This Tea Party, Koch brother extremism is something akin only to itself. It's the continuation of the white Southern strategy that was started by Kevin Phillips right at the end of the 60s and on into the 70s, where the whole goal, as Kevin Phillips said, was find out who doesn't like each other, divide them, and that's how you win. Or when Lee Atwater in 1981 said, we got to learn a new way to talk about race. We can't talk about race straight up, so let's talk about tax cuts and states' rights and those things. But the result of that is to develop policies that hurt black folk, but they also end up hurting all Americans. Because the myth of extremism is that we can come up with these little hot-button issues and just hurt some people, but the reality is extremism ends up hurting everybody. And so we're in this battle of whether or not extremism is going to take America's public policy down the low road to political destruction, or whether we're going to find a pathway to higher ground. And we believe what we have found in North Carolina, when we've seen this onslaught of extremism, that what builds a coalition for people to stand against it is when you have what we call a deeply moral, deeply constitutional, indigenously led, transformative, anti-poverty, anti-racist fusion movement, coalition fusion movement at the state level to challenge what's going on in these various states. Now, the religious right that's often so wrong, has worked hard over the years to suggest that the only moral issues in the public square are abortion, homosexuality, and prayer in the school. And they fed that constantly into the public mindset. Part of it was deliberately done because after Dr. King was killed, there was an element in this country that said we were never again going to allow that kind of leadership to rise with that clear of a moral voice on issues that really matter. The reality is the religious rights, four or five issues, form of theological heresy. Because the four or five issues they talk about, there are only about five or six scriptures in the whole Bible that deal with those issues. In fact, there's no scripture in the Bible about prayer in the schools, or about prayer in the home. The issues they deal with are four or five, maybe six scriptures. And they interpret most, misinterpret most of them, and none of the scriptures that they quote override the premier moral instruction of the Bible, and that is to love your neighbor as yourself. So much of the religious right stuff is written, is codified in a kind of hatred towards certain people. Now you take that, take the same Bible that they quote, whether it's Old or New Testament, you can find 2,000 scriptures that deal with the issue of how you treat the poor, how you treat women, how you treat children, how you treat people on the margin. You don't ever hear them quote those scriptures. You don't hear them. So I often say that the religious right, they're really not conservatives, because conserve means to hold on to the essence of it. So if you are not holding on to love and justice and care for your fellow man or woman, you're not conservative, because that's the essence of any faith. All of our faith traditions basically say, when it comes to the public square, how we use public power, it should be directed to how we lift up people. Like, for instance, Isaiah 10 says it like this: woe unto those who pass unjust laws and rob the poor of their rights. Isaiah talks about the poor having rights. The religious right and the Tea Party extremists often talk about the rights of landowners. But God talks about the rights of poor. Or Matthew 23, when I was hungry, did you feed me? When I was naked, did you clothe me? That's an instruction not to individual charity, that's an instruction to society. Because that scripture says he will call the nation. It didn't say he will call individuals, he will call the nation. And one will end up on the left side and one will end up on the right based on how they cared about the poor. Jesus' first sermon, when he said, I've come to preach good news to the poor, the word in Greek is patokos, it means those who have been made poor through by the economic exploitation of the dominant society. That's what that word literally means in Greek. And then, of course, when Jesus was on the way to the cross, his last sermon, he said, he told his disciples he needed to focus on the more weightier matters of the law, which are love, justice, and mercy. So all of our faith traditions say the deep moral issues for our society are issues of justice and love and care for the least of these. Even our Constitution, wherever I go, I say, it always amazes me to be politicians. I've heard your governor, Nathan, when he was running, he talked about freedom, freedom, freedom. They quote that word like that's the whole concept of the Constitution, freedom. The Constitution doesn't even start with freedom. Freedom is like, a few lines down, it says, we the people of the United States in order to form a more perfect union. And then it said, the first principle is not to establish freedom, it's to establish justice. Then it says, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for common defense, and promote the general welfare. So how did welfare become a negative word if welfare is in the Constitution? And then after you do those things, justice, domestic tranquility, common defense, and welfare, then you get to the blessings of freedom. Because freedom to oppress people is tyranny, and that's not freedom. So what has happened in our politics, we've actually had a kind of a fever go on in our political language that has stolen the kind of language that allows you to have a better society, because language is either a tool of oppression or a tool of liberation. And that's why we believe this kind of moral framework helps to recover that language. The other thing about it is we have to challenge the fact that many people claiming to be Republicans are not. And we don't need to get trapped in that lane. I know a lot of good Republicans. My granddaddy was one. That's why you got to have a movement that's an independent movement. Our movement, when we started 7 years ago, we started out criticizing Democrats. We had to fight Democrats to get same-day registration and early voting. We had to fight Democrats to get them to support health care reform and earned income tax credit. So don't think that somehow we just had the legislature back in the hand of Democrats, all the fights would be over. That's why you have to have an independent moral movement, constitutional movement, that challenges all parties. But the difference with many of the people who are currently claiming to be Republican, the reality is they are extremists. And you need a movement that calls, that does not say, we want Democrats in, we want Republicans in, that says what we don't want is this extremism. And we want everybody in that disagrees with extremism. Then you can unpack that. So one of the things we do in the movement back home is we say, first of all, our legislature claims this is a Republican takeover of the legislature that's been, and we've been absent from the legislature for 140 years. Well, our comeback is Republicans are still absent. You're not Republican. They said, what are you talking about? I said, well, first of all, ought to carry the name of your dad and the actions of your dad. Now, your dad is Abraham Lincoln. He fought for voting rights. He fought against slavery. He fought for education. So how do you claim to be a Republican and every time, every bill you write is fighting against voting rights and against education? You claim to be a Republican? Let's go to your uncle, Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt was a Republican. But Teddy Roosevelt said there were four issues that ought to be at the center of anybody's, the center of any party's political platform, even his: labor rights and living wages. Teddy Roosevelt, Republican. Health care, public education, and protection of the environment. So how do you claim to be a Republican when the bills you pass are against labor rights, against environmental justice, you see, against public education? Let's go to your first cousin, Eisenhower. Eisenhower said in 1957, when he passed the National Education Defense Act, that public education was a matter of national defense. So how do you claim to be, and he put more money in public education than any other president before him. So how do you claim, Mr. Scott Walker or Mr. Pat McCrory in my state, to be a Republican when your first cousin, Eisenhower, put more money in public education than any person before him, and every chance you get, you're cutting education and trying to put vouchers in place to rob public schools. And especially doing it now, 60 years after Brown, you're trying to go backwards. Y'all see what I'm saying? Then we'll say something like now, and also Eisenhower said, any party that would attack health care and attack public education, and he said nothing, I can't figure out what the other one was, but he said, would soon not be a party in this nation. He wrote a letter to his brother and basically outlined all the things he said a Republican Party shouldn't attack are the things that these extremists are attacking. Then let's go to your daughter, Ronald Reagan. I don't agree with Ronald Reagan a whole lot of stuff. But Ronald Reagan agreed with earned income tax credit. So did George Herbert Walker Bush, that just jumped out the plane yesterday. So did Clinton. So how do you claim to be a Republican, Governor Walker, or Governor McCrory in North Carolina, when you cut earned income tax credit? You claim that you cut taxes, but then you cut earned income tax, which means you raise taxes on the working poor so you can give tax cuts to the wealthy. And so what we say, and then you got black Republicans like Edward Brooks, former Senator of Massachusetts, Ralph Bunche, Benjamin Hooks, the former executive director of the NAACP, was a Lincoln Eisenhower Republican. They all fought for public education and voting rights. So our argument is the current crowd, they claim to be Republican, but they're extremists. And we saw that just the other day when Eric Cantor lost. Now, Eric Cantor got an F on the NAACP report card, so he was an extremist. But the folk that elected him are more extreme than he is. Now, think about that. When you cannot be elected and somebody can claim you're not conservative enough and you stood against health care reform, you believe in cutting taxes for the wealthy, you even stood up and believed in government shutdown, and you're not conservative enough, that means our moral compass is way off in this country. And so you must resist calling people Republicans who are actually extremists. And if you call them extremists, you will get some Republicans to come with you. See, but if you just attack people as being Republican, you're going to push some people away. You have to attack the policy. And you have to call the policies extremists and say, look, these policies do not match our deepest moral values, and they don't even match your own history. And when you create that kind of opening, you can actually create a coalition where a lot of people will stand with you who otherwise wouldn't stand with you. For instance, in this state, they cut public education and voucherize. You got to build a coalition that gets the facts out there, not just about how that's hurting black people, but how it's hurting all children. And show the intersectionality. And show how it's going to hurt teachers and teachers' jobs, regardless of what they're a part of. Medicaid. The governor is denying Medicaid. So you got to build a coalition that doesn't just say it's hurting black people. You got to say it's hurting, let's just say, I don't know what the number, in North Carolina, denial of Medicaid expansion has hurt 500,000 people. 500,000 people in North Carolina means there's white people in that 500,000, there's black people in that 500,000, there's Republicans in that 500,000, there's some Democrats in that 500,000. So you put a face on. We got 1.6 million poor people in North Carolina, 600,000 of them are children. You deny 500,000 people Medicaid, you deny blind people, aged people, disabled people, older people. You put that face on. Earned income tax credit, when they cut it in North Carolina, I don't know what the numbers are here, it denied 900,000 people earned income tax credit. 900,000, almost a million people. The way we talk about it, we didn't say, that just hurts black people. We said, wait a minute, you raised tax on 900,000 people, so you could cut taxes for 23 of the wealthiest families. You see how we frame the language? Now, then we disaggregate. We say, now in that 900,000, this amount was black, this amount was white, this amount. And then we said, but this is how many people you hurt in the rural area. This is how many people you hurt in the Piedmont. This is how many people you hurt in the West. And on top of that, you went against Ronald Reagan, who's your dog. And on top of that, you took money out of the economy. You know, I forget how many millions of dollars that would have benefited the economy. Or when we talk about Medicaid, we talk about how it's hurt so many people, but it also took $8 billion away from the economy, $23 million in advertising, and is closing hospitals. So this coming week, you're going to see me on TV with a Republican mayor whose hospital is closing in Bellhaven because of the cut. We're on TV together saying, look, he and I don't agree on everything. But we do agree that Medicaid expansion ought to be, and he was on TV last week saying, my party is wrong because you don't do this just because you don't like a president. If you want to fight this issue, fight it at the federal level, but you ought to give us this Medicaid expansion. And he signed a letter with me criticizing his own governor and demanding that his governor meet with us and then said on the record, and I don't know why the governor's ignoring me. I'm a mayor. Now, he may not like that offer, but why is he ignoring me? I'm a mayor and a member of his own party. And my friend, that's new.
That's new.
And he's going to be in my church Sunday.
Oh,
you hear what I'm saying? And we're going to be on Chris Hayes together, and we're going to ride together. And MSNBC is doing a big story on how can an African-American pastor in the South, president of NAACP, be teamed up. We marched together. He called for us. He sent for us. Said, will you bring the movement down here? Because I don't know what to do. All I know is my hospital is going to close, and people are going to die. White people going to die. Black people going to die. Republicans going to die. You see what I'm saying, Marvel? He said, Reverend Father, and he told me, he said, Carlos, listen, we have fundamental disagreements on some things, but some stuff, he said, Reverend Father, just right. And some things just wrong. And then the leading minister in the city had a heart attack, and if he hadn't had the hospital there, he would have died, because if the hospital wasn't there, he'd have been 2 hours from the emergency room. And he has members in his church that hate President Obama and hate Medicaid expansion. But now that preacher has had a revelation. Marmo. So Let me just close by saying this, not if the media wants to ask any questions. We've got to have a way so that we look at public policy through the moral lens of justice, the common good, and the good of the whole. And it has to be a movement that brings people together, black, white, Latino, Native American, Democrat, Republican, Independent, gay, straight, people of all faith, people who struggle with faith, immigrants, business leaders, workers, doctors, uninsured, and you stand there in all of that diversity. And tomorrow I'll talk about some of the steps and even how civil disobedience in a moral movement has to be a part of it. And what I can tell you is building on 7 years, last year, Brother Wendell, building on 17 years after these folks just went after every progressive thing in the state, people were depressed. What are we going to do? And so 17 of us went into the legislature to sing, pray, and talk about the problem on April 29th. We had no plans of doing anything beyond the first day. We just knew somebody had to go in, and we went in to say we would be arrested before we were to give up our Constitution. Right? The next week, Pope came back. We didn't call him. When we stood up, see, there are people in this state, you have credibility. And if you go and stand up and get arrested, other people will follow you because they'll know something is wrong because you wouldn't be out there doing it just for fun. Next week, people came. We said, we might need to organize this. Next week, people came. By the end of the summer, nearly 1,000 people were arrested. 15,000 people came to the Capitol. Average about 2,500 to 3,000 people every Monday. By this next February of this past year, 80,000 people showed up in the dead of winter. We've had 117 actions since April of last year. 117. We've had 40 Moral Monday events outside of Raleigh. We had 17 in Raleigh, but over 40 outside of Raleigh in different communities. So this is long term. This is a marathon. It's not a sprint. When we started, the governor was at 50%. Now he's under 30. When we started, the legislature was at 40%. Now they're under 19. When we started, we hardly had any papers with us. Now every major newspaper has written an editorial saying this movement is right. And these folks are extremists. And what they're doing is bad for North Carolina. And the movement continues to grow. Today, when I was coming to Carver, I called the office because we're training 40 young people to go into 50 counties, and we're doing Freedom Summer 50 years after Freedom Summer in 63. And we got a little resources to do that we didn't have when we started the movement. But because we started the movement, some people saw what we were doing, and they said, we want to help you. That's how Mary McLeod Bethune built Bethune-Cookman. She went on a garbage dump and started working. Somebody said, what you doing out there, crazy lady? She said, I'm building a school. Somebody said, go there and help that crazy lady. She don't build that school there. And that's how she got. You get help by doing. You don't get help by saying, if you give us, then we'll do. You get help by saying, things are so desperate now that silence would be betrayed. That's what Dr. King said. And you do it. You get, Fannie Lou Hamer, you get sick and tired of being sick and tired. And you do something. And then people will join you. In the doing. I won't success you. We've done everything right. God knows I've made a lot of mistakes. And tomorrow I'll try to share with you the best practices, but also some of the mistakes we made. And hopefully, then I'll leave, because my job is not to try to lead a national movement. State movements have to be national. The goal is not to raise up a leader. Isaiah had a school of prophets. The goal is not to lay up one. The goal is for every state to be where these extremists are, for us to put a national spotlight on those states and to shift the center of gravity. And the final thing I say to the media, people always ask, well, what if you all lose this fall's election? Well, won't that be a sign that you lost your deal? I said, no. I said, first of all, the moral movement is not a sprint, it's a marathon. The goal of it is to shift the consciousness and the context and the contour and the center of political gravity. So much so that the day will come when people who got elected to do one thing won't be able to do it. Because you have changed the conversation and the consciousness, i.e. Lyndon Baines Johnson. He's a Democrat. He didn't plan to be the leader of civil rights legislation. He was a segregationist. But the movement, and I see some gray hairs in here, that y'all started, y'all messed that man up. You all got in the street. You all went to jail. You raised this moral issue all over this country. And Lyndon Baines Johnson had to go on TV and talk about civil rights being a moral issue. The war on poverty being a moral issue. You raised so much sand that John Kennedy didn't plan to be a leader. He told Dr. King, don't come to D.C. Stop all this arrest. Dr. King said, can't do it. Got to shift. They got to change the consciousness of the state of the country. So what did John Kennedy do yesterday, 50 years ago? He went on TV and announced the plan for the Civil Rights Act of 60, that would be the Civil Rights Act of 64. And we didn't have the votes. But the movement produced the vote. Megan Ellis got killed yesterday, 50 years ago. His death didn't stop the movement, it spurred the movement. And because they shifted the context, and as Dr. King said, the movement became a thermostat rather than a thermometer. And that's what I believe we have to have again today. And if we do this, we will be, our children will write down, will remember us in their history books. And so I'm calling on those of you that suited up before to suit up one more time. And those that never suited up, we live off the benefits of other folks' struggle, we need to suit up for the first time. I'm too long, but thank you.
Thank you.